So my name is Sean Bautista. I'm an alcoholic and I'm an addict. I guess I'm not like Chris's normal speakers because I don't have any musical talent whatsoever. However, I do have a talent. I can show it to you if you guys all stand up. Okay, you can sit down. My talent is I can get pretty much anybody to do whatever the fuck I want when I want them to do it, right? Which is really useful when I was a dope fiend. So I was born in El Paso, Texas. If anybody knows where that is, it's a horrible place. I was born on May 27th, 1980. I lived in a pretty normal, at least what I thought was pretty normal neighborhood. I was raised by my grandparents. My dad was in medical school when I was little, so I didn't really see him very often. He was out doing his residency. And my mom was a secretary at a doctor's office. She got accused of stealing a dollar or some shit. That's what she told me. And from that day, she quit and she went to nursing school, then became a nurse practitioner, and then became an OBGYN. So growing up, we spent a lot of time with our grandparents, right? And I did whatever I wanted to do. Like, I got ice cream every day. We got toys every day. Point being is that I had a pretty solid foundation. You know, like, I didn't come from a broken home. I didn't come from a lot of hardships a lot of individuals come from that I grew up with in El Paso. It's a pretty poor community, right? So going through middle school, or let's say elementary school, I mean, the same old shit that everybody happens. Like, some people get bullied. I probably bullied a bunch of people. In general, I didn't like school. I just didn't like doing it. And I found really soon that I could cheat, right? And I could, like, bullshit my parents and be like, no, I don't have any homework. I don't have anything to do today, you know? And then I would go in early and I would, like, tell my buddy, like, hey, dude, I forgot to do my homework. Can I borrow your homework? And, you know, lo and behold, Sean passed with A's, right? This carried on through high school. And in high school, I played sports. Growing up, I played sports. I played tennis and I played soccer. And I was really good in soccer. I actually had a scholarship to play soccer in college. But with that being said, being in El Paso, which is a predominantly Hispanic community, myself being Hispanic, I don't look it, but I am it. Soccer's big there, right? Soccer's bigger than football down there. So I was really well known for being good in soccer. And I didn't have to do anything. I remember having, like, this zero period because I, like, failed two of my English classes, and I had to have this class to graduate. And the teacher was like, you need to rest. You need to rest. Like, I'll just send you the assignments and then turn them in at the end of the 6 weeks. You don't even have to come to class. And I was like, this is fucking great, right? And I didn't have to do shit. So growing up in El Paso, we're on the border of Mexico, right? And everything's legal in Mexico. When I was growing in, it was pseudo-safe to go over there when I was growing up. So you learn to grow up really quick because we were drinking in bars at the age of 16. Like, full-fledged bars, cocaine, alcohol, prostitutes, whatever you wanted to do, you could get it in Juarez. And it was literally a sea of kids walking over, getting shit-faced, and walking back. And all they asked is if you were American when you came back, and the only time they held you was if you were too drunk and you threw up on them, right? They didn't care. They didn't care. Drugs were good there. Drugs were cheap there. But my point is that you had to grow up really fast. So we were exposed to a lot of things that a lot of people in other communities don't experience, right? It's not unnormal for us to be there and somebody's lying dead on the streets. That's just like, oh, shit, that dude, fuck, sucks for you, right? That's what we think because we're just so used to that kind of stuff. So anyway, we partied pretty hard in high school, and it was time for me to graduate, and I had a scholarship to play on the start team at UT Austin here in town. And I didn't want to go. I remember, like, getting the offer letter, and my parents were like, you need to sign, you need to do your commitment. And I was like, I don't want to go to college yet. I don't feel like I'm ready, you know? Like, I want to stay here and party in Mexico with all my other friends. So I wound up going, you know, obviously, like, my mom. Yeah, you're going. And if you even know my parents, oh, fuck, you're going to college if they say you're going to college. So I went to college, and I failed out. I got a 0.0. I didn't go to any of my classes. I realized, like, there's 1,500 of you dudes in here, and I don't have to do shit. And then I thought I was going to cheat on the exams. Well, no, that didn't happen. So I failed out, and I had to go home. I had to go back to El Paso, and I went to UTEP, which is a decent school. But I had already been exposed to, like, binge drinking and, you know, like, really partying. And UT, there's a lot of money. There's a lot of students that have a lot of money there, and it's kind of like you can do whatever you want, because if you get in trouble, their parents are going to bail you out. You're going to get a lawyer. They know somebody tied to government here or some shit, right? So I went back with that same mentality, and I was like, I'm invisible. I can do whatever I want. We have, you know, friends that are in the government or lawyers. And I got humbled really quick because my dad was like, you don't have any money. We have money, but you're fucking broke, right? And you owe us $12,000 for that scholarship you fucking blew off. So I somehow managed to make 6 A's during 2 summer sessions at UTEP, and I went to a college in San Antonio called Trinity University. It's a small private school, and I got to play soccer there too. And it was kind of a different experience because it's a really small school, right? There's only 3,000 students, including grad students there. So my classes were like 15, 20 people. So if you weren't there, like, I'm pretty sure my grandma died 7 times, my mom was in the hospital. Like, I used every excuse I could because I didn't want to show up to class. But then they would call you, and then they'd show up to your dorm because you had to live in the dorms for 3 years when you go to that college. And they're like, hey, like, I heard your grandma died and you're still here, and like you were at the frat party last weekend. Anyway, so I did pretty good my freshman year, and I got hurt playing soccer. I got slide tackled against a goalie post and they shattered my ankle. And I had multiple surgeries. Like the day that I went to the hospital, they had to do emergency surgery, and then I had 4 follow-up surgeries. And that's when I got really introduced to pain pills, and I was like, damn, these things are fucking badass. Like, you feel good, you know, and I kind of, at the time, was probably suffering from some, you know, bipolar disorder that I know that I have now, and some severe anxiety. And every time I took that pain pill, it wasn't just to take the pain away in my ankle, it was to take the pain away or numb me, right? It always, and my roommate used to take them with me. He'd be like, hey, man, let me get a couple of those. I was like, sweet, you know, here, you can have 2. And we used to have this saying that, like, the nighttime is the right time. So there was already some addict bullshit happening there. I just didn't know it, right? Because I was like, I'll never take these painkillers to numb myself during the day because that's what junkies do, right? But I'll definitely split that 8-ball with you and take a few tonight because tonight, that's what we do. It's time to party. So my prescriptions ran out. And they're like, you don't need them anymore. Okay, so I met up with this guy that I went to college with that was from Houston. And this is when, like, the whole pill craze was going crazy. And he used to drive to Houston and buy 5,000 pills for $4,000 and drive right back. So we were good, right? And I thought, I take 2, 3. Then I start doing that shit where I start budgeting them out, you know? Like, I put 3 here, and then I put 3 in my drawer, and then I put 3 in my coat pocket. Because if I ever lose it or ever forget about it, like, I'm the type of guy that washes his clothes and finds $50 in 4 different pairs of jeans. You know, you're like, oh, shit, bonus, right? And then cocaine started to kind of definitely flow through. And unfortunately, that was my fault. Because we went down to El Paso with some of my school friends for Thanksgiving. And I took them to Juarez. And they were like, hey, can we get drugs here? And I was like, yeah, you just go right around here and you get it. Well, 2 of those guys met up with some guys that sold for the cartel, and they started shipping that shit to Trinity University by the kilo. And I don't know, I think I just wanted to be involved in it. I wanted to, you know, I had no reason to sell drugs. I didn't need the money. But it was the stigma, I guess, that I was looking for, like the, oh, like, that's Sean, he's the one that has the cocaine hookup, whatever. So I got really, really addicted to coke. So the second summer that I was at Trinity, I knew that I needed to do something. I was like, I can't leave here and go home because I'm going to get sick if I don't have pain pills, and I can't get too far away from Houston because then how am I going to get them? How am I going to justify making an 11-hour drive to Houston for? I don't. I would have come up with some shit, but who knows? So this is where my life gets really interesting. So I convinced my parents to send me to Paris for the next 3 summers to go to culinary school at the original Cordon Bleu. Hence all the food tattoos all over my body. This spoon is not for shooting dope, in case anybody's asking. I get that all the time, and I wish I would have used my head before I got that tattoo. Especially when I'm in meetings and people are like, damn, you used to bang heroin? And I was like, no, dude, I used to fucking eat salad. Fuck. So anyway, I was really into cooking. I didn't know what I wanted to do. Like, I didn't know what I wanted to do with life. And my undergrad degree was in neuroscience, and I thought I was going to go into medicine like my parents. And I was like, no, this sucks. Like, yeah, it's too much work. You have to study too much. And I think my parents sent me to Paris for the summer just so I didn't fucking bug them, right? And they figured, like, just send him up there, and he won't cost us any money and, like, wrecking his car or, like, DWI fees or whatever. So I got pretty serious into that, and I came back. I finished my undergrad in neuroscience, and then I got a master's in psychology. They had a one-year master's program at Trinity. And the only reason that I got my master's is because I didn't want to get a job. I was like, I'm going to milk this for as long as I can, right? So I finished, and my parents were like, what are you going to do now? Like, are you going to get your counseling license? And my uptight, snobby attitude is like, why the fuck do I want to sit around and listen to a bunch of people's problems? Like, that doesn't sound fun at all. Who the fuck cares about those people? Is what I thought, right? Now I have a completely different respect for people in this field. So I graduated, and then I moved to New York City, and I did some apprentice cooking in Hell's Kitchen in various restaurants in New York City. And then a buddy that I went to college with, we opened up a restaurant and a microbrewery in Fort Worth right near TCU off Hewlin called The Covey. And that's when I learned how to power drink. For real, because when you have a brewery, yeah, I still put lime and salt in all of his beers. He hated that shit, but whatever, it's good for me. So we opened up this restaurant, you know, and I thought I knew what I was doing, and I was working with people like Tim Love, and I don't know if any of you guys know who he is, but he's a pretty famous chef that owns a few restaurants in Dallas. Anyway, we opened our restaurants at the same time, and my restaurant wound up being more successful. And I was like 26 at the time. I thought I knew everything. I thought I was a badass. I thought I was like a New York hot chef that was going to like do cocaine on the line every day and wake up and live in a skyrise condo. And that shit did not work. I lived in an apartment that was 3 floors that was horrible. And I stayed up on cocaine until 2 or 3 in the morning. And then I would binge drink till I could fall asleep. And then I'd wake up and I'd do it again. Right? And I thought that was normal. Like, I was like, no, this shit's good. Like, this is what chefs do. Chefs don't really do that shit. They really don't. So, again, that habit started, like, creeping up, you know, and I would kind of, like, wave. I'd go up and down, I'd go up and down. And I always thought, like, I can tame it down, you know? Like, I'm not getting, like, super dope sick. I'm not shaking. What I considered it was like I just had a bad hangover, right? 2-day hangover. I'd hook myself up to an IV with one of my nurse friends or like drink a bunch of Pedialyte and I'd be fine. Well, these like occurrences started happening a lot more often, right? Like things started happening to me and like life started getting shitty. I got engaged when I had that restaurant. Like, why the fuck? I didn't even know. Like, I can't even remember the girl's last name, to be honest with you. I swear to God, I cannot remember. I was making notes, and that's where I stopped because I was like, fuck, what's her name? I wonder if I could get that ring back. So anyway, I found out that the restaurant world and my smart ass didn't really know shit about what I was doing. So I called my parents and I said, look, I'm packing up a U-Haul, and I'm getting the fuck out of Dallas. I'm going to come back to El Paso. And I got back to El Paso, and they immediately were like, there's something going on, and I didn't want to tell them anything. They're like, we need to see a psychiatrist. And I did the same thing that most addicts, not every addict, but most addicts do, is I bullshitted them, right? I was like, I just have some anxiety about this. Do you use drugs? No. No, I don't use drugs. Do you drink regularly? No, maybe occasion. Right? That's bullshit. I probably snorted up some blow as soon as I walked out of his office, because that's my style. Right? No bullshit. I sat in an AA meeting, went out to the car and smoked the foily one time and walked back in. Bunch of old people, and I was tripping balls. Tripping balls. Yeah, that's a story in itself. So I had my kind of first run-in, right, with psychiatrist and having to open up and be honest, and that mentality of, like, I can bullshit, I can get people to do whatever I want them to do. And honestly, what I was trying to get them to do was to prescribe me Adderall and Xanax, right, so that I could get on Adderall, and then I could have the Xanax to come down. And God knows that prescription would have lasted, like, 5 days, right? Because I just don't know how to regulate that shit. So I kind of, in El Paso, there's not a lot of mental health. Like, I was just there for work. There's a couple of treatment centers. There's, like, a detox, but the treatment centers are mental institutions also, right? They share beds. There's, like, 4 for detox, 3 for battered women. Like, there's nothing like this. Right? There's nothing like this. By the way, I'm a 2-time loser at AR, too. I'll get to the rest of that later. So I started to kind of get honest with my mom, who's always been, like, my best friend, my biggest fan, but my biggest critic, you know, because she can see right through my bullshit. To this day, she can, like, call me out, even on the phone. I'm like, she'll send me a text like, you're lying. I'm like, fuck. How do you know that? Right? So I kind of, I got back, you know, into a groove. I started doing some counseling with a therapist rather than a psychiatrist. And my parents were like, so what are you going to do? Like, you have a degree in neuroscience, you have a degree in psychology, and you also have a degree in culinary arts. And I was like, well, I can't go back to cooking because I can't stay sober doing that. Right? And the word sober wasn't really used back then because I didn't ever admitted that I had a problem. I'd never been to an AA meeting. I didn't even know what the fuck AA or NA was. Nor did I care. I thought it was a bunch of old dudes smoking in a room, right? Not people like me going out to their car and smoking boilies and coming back in. So my dad suggested, he said, you know, you're a very high intensity guy. You're competitive. You like sports. You like action. And he said, why don't you come to my hospital and hang out in the ER for a few shifts and see if that's something that you might want to do. So I did, right? First hour that I'm in the ER, a trauma comes in and this guy's being wheeled in on a stretcher, and this guy jumps on top of him and intubates him, sticks a tube down his throat and starts bagging him. And they're wheeling him to surgery, and I'm just watching like, what the fuck was that? And how do I get that job? Right? That's, swear to God, that's what got me into medicine. So my mom graduated from Texas Tech Medical School, and I was very privileged and fortunate that if you graduate from there, you have a little bit of say if your son gets into the program. So I did a fast-track nursing program because what that guy was doing was a certified registered nurse anesthetist. He does anesthesia. That's what he was doing. He was getting the guy ready for surgery. And I didn't want to go to med school because I probably wasn't smart enough to go to med school, and I didn't want to be in school for another 8 years. So being a CRNA, you can go to school. I could get my nursing license and then do 2 years in ICU and then go to 2 years of anesthesia school. So things were going great. I kicked ass in nursing school. I did really well. I got into surgery. I was working in surgery. And then I got transferred up to oncology, which is dealing with cancer patients. The whole time, I still had a secret pill addiction. I went through school straight A's in nursing school on pills. Fucking scary, right? So then I'm now, think about this, I'm hanging bags of chemo for cancer patients while I'm high on pain pills. Thank God I'm not your nurse, right? And now I'm going to share something with you that I think I've probably only told a handful of people in this world, but I want you to understand how bad this addiction got me, right? It's not a war story. This is just how bad this was. In oncology, you get close to patients, right? They're there for several days, several weeks at a time getting chemo, and you see a lot of people die. A lot of those patients are on very heavy narcotics like fentanyl patches, right? Morphine drips. I knew I had a problem when a patient died, and I asked the family to step out so I could take that fentanyl patch off their loved one and put it in my pocket so I could get high later. It's pretty fucking shitty, right? Somebody just died, and the only thing I thought was jackpot. I just put that fentanyl patch on an hour ago, and it's 100 mics worth, and I'm going to be good for 3 days, right? And that was my thought. I'm not going to be sick for 3 days. Because addiction was no longer fun for me. It was no longer about feeling numb. It was about not feeling sick. And my parents had pulled all these strings for me to get into the hospital. And I did not have the nerve or the know-how to ask for help. To say, hey, you know what? I'm a fucking drug addict, Mom. Dad, I'm a drug addict. What do I do to get help? I checked myself into it's called the UBH, University Behavioral Health. I talked to a doctor friend of mine privately, and he said, you should try this out, and he's an idiot, because that place was horrible. The reason that he told them that I was checking myself in was because I wanted to kill myself, which was not true at all. But if any of you ever work in this field in recovery, there's one phrase that can get somebody treatment right away. You know what that phrase is, right? I'm going to hurt myself. It's not something I like to throw around, but there's some people that I wish I would have called that wolf for, right? So I get into this hospital, and then I wind up checking myself out a day later. And I told them they were full of shit, and I was going to be fine. And when I worked in oncology, you work very closely with the doctors, right? And you work, and the prescription pads are pretty readily available. Keep in mind, this was 8 years ago. Okay, so 8 years ago. And we used to write prescriptions for patients all the time. Like, the doctor would be like, send them home with this, 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 and this, write the prescription, and then stamp it. So one day, I was trying to kick the pills on my own and still had a little bit of a cocaine habit. Little to me, probably big to a lot of you guys. But anyway, I wrote these prescriptions for myself, and I was like, I'm going to do it a couple of times just so that I don't get sick. And as soon as these prescriptions are out, I'm going to go get help, or I'm going to go tell my parents, or I'm going to go tell my grandparents that I needed help. And I didn't. I probably wrote 40 would be an underestimate, probably 50 to 60 is more accurate. And at that time, my grandma had just been diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer and rheumatoid arthritis. And remember, my grandparents were the ones that raised me, right? They were the ones that were there for me all the time. I could do no wrong in their eyes. My grandfather's still alive to this day, and it broke my heart to have to leave him because he still lives in El Paso. But I talked to him every other day. You know, and he just celebrated his 86th birthday, which is pretty fucking amazing to me. So I stopped writing those prescriptions, right? You know why? Because I started stealing from my grandmother. I started going out of my grandmother's house and asking her to stand up, like I asked you all to stand up. And when she stand up, I'd go to her bedroom and I'd steal all her medications, I'd replace it with ibuprofen or something, because she didn't know the difference in the pills. This continued on for quite some time, and then it started turning into stealing heirloom jewelry from my parents. I stole a 3-carat diamond ring that was my grandmother's, that was supposed to be my sister's. I pawned it for $800. $800, and I blew that shit probably in a day. And you know, the thing was is that when I did these things, I didn't even feel bad. I didn't feel bad. And these are amends now that I have to continuously, even though I've made them with the majority of the people that I can, like the 12 steps ask you to do, I'm not okay with it, right? I tried my hardest when I was in El Paso. I had $10,000 saved up, and I tried to go find where that ring was and see if there was a paper trail, and I would pay that person $10,000 in cash so I could get that ring back. I couldn't find it. I hired a private investigator to look for it. He couldn't come up with anything either. So, I'm an addict. I'm a full-fledged addict. I was living on my own in El Paso, and then paying rent was expensive. So I moved over to my parents' house, and they lived in this really nice house in a gated community. And I came home from work one day, and I chugged a bottle of Jack Daniels that my dad had there. I took a morphine pill, and I smoked a foily, and the DEA kicked my parents' front door down. High as fuck. It had been some time, like years, since I'd writ those prescriptions. But I wrote a date wrong on one, and so that's how they caught me, God damn it. So they caught me. And I had 40 felony charges of fraudulent prescriptions. My first offer was 40 years in jail. 40 years in jail for writing a... And you know what? The stupid thing is I wrote it for Vicodin 5 milligram. I should have gone for the Gusto and wrote an 80 milligram Oxycontin. Right? I was scared. I was scared to go to jail. Scared I was going to get my ass kicked. Luckily, when I was in high school and I used to run around with these little cartel kids, I had some tattoos that allowed me to be protected when I got in. They said, we can't put you in the normal cell. You have to go over there with all the other guys that have those same tattoos. Probably the only smart tattoo I ever fucking got, right? So I got out of jail, and I didn't know what to do, and I called work, and they said, by the way, you're fired, and you lost your nursing license, and you're on a 5-year suspension, and you'll never practice medicine ever again, and my dreams of being a CRNA just went down the toilet. My sister lived in Austin. My brother lived in Austin. I called my brother, and I said, hey, man, can you pick me up from the airport? I need to get the fuck out of El Paso. And I did. And I came up here. And I thought that maybe I could, like, apply for these jobs because whatever I choose to do, I'm good at. If I put my mind to it, I'm good at it. Just like every one of you, I guarantee, like, some addicts are some smart-ass people. Right? We're determined. I worked for Oxford House, and I used to have people tell me that they couldn't come up with rent. But, motherfucker, you can. Because you could come up with money for dope. Now, I'm not telling you to go rob somebody, but when you got to hustle, fucking hustle, right? We grind. That's what we do. That's what we do. If you want something, go fucking get it. That's how I got this watch. I'm just kidding. So I thought that, you know, hey, what I can do is I can go, like, I just got arrested. I flew up to Austin. I can go get hired somewhere really quickly, and then it's not going to show up, right? Like, I'm going to try to beat the system. I'm already doing some weasel-ass shit. Unfortunately, that's like a national registry, and I got every job. I bullshit you not. 4 jobs I interviewed for. Got them. Same day. We're sorry, Mr. Bautista, but you're a fucking felon. You check no on the box. I hadn't been sentenced yet. So, I did what I had to do. I bought a food trailer. I borrowed some money from my aunt. and I bought a food trailer. And guess what? I was successful, and I had three of them, and then I became a drug addict again. Because cooking food on not ecstasy. Where the fuck did I didn't even like ecstasy? Fucking autocorrect. So anyway, that happened, right? And then I paired up. I'm not going to mention the bar's name, but I paired up with a really successful bar here in town that held the record for highest bar sales for a couple of years. I became partners in that, and the money flew into my pockets. I bought a house. I had a pretty nice car. I have some pretty nice watches. But I don't have shit else. Right? Do y'all care about what kind of fucking car I drive? I don't, because I just had to make the car payment 4 days ago, and it fucking sucks. Do you even know what kind of watch this is? You don't care. I'm the only one that cares. And I think you care, which is probably why I wore it. Egotistical motherfucker, let me tell you. So, I was doing really well, and I was on probation. So let me tell you what happened with the fucking charges. I paid an attorney. El Paso is a great place when it comes to crooked-ass attorneys and fucking judges. The judge went to sentence me. It got reduced down to six charges of fraudulent prescriptions of a narcotic medication. And she told me, Mr. Bautista, I don't know what's wrong with you or why you would do this, but you have a problem. You should probably get some help. And I thought about that. I still think about that shit every day. I should have probably got some help. No, bitch. You should have probably made me get some help. Right? That's how I feel about that shit. Story gets even better. So I get sentenced to 5 years probation after a $25,000 lawyer bill that I still pay my parents back $1,000 a month for. So I get myself into... So I'm on probation, right? I'm still using, and I'm still drinking, and I'm still snorting coke until 3 days before I have to go into my probation thing, and I put on a really nice suit, and I bullshit her and tell her how fucking good I'm doing and that I think that this is the best thing that ever happened to me until I manipulate her to not drug test me anymore. And I, shit you not, I leave the Travis County probation part, and I drive down to Stasny, and I pick up my dope, and I go home and get high that same day. It's awesome. I'm like, yes, I have another month before I have to go see this bitch. Now, time and money for me are really bad. Really bad. Because with money, delivery comes pretty awesome, right? Make a phone call, bring me that big amount, I'll pay you a little extra. So I got myself into trouble, and I went to detox, and I wound up here. I didn't even know where the fuck this place was. In fact, when I was driving here today and I noticed that they tore up the road and made it a dirt road now, I was like, damn, this looks familiar, right? So I came in, I met Miss Karen. How many of y'all have Miss Karen as a counselor? Fuck. She will be at my funeral, I guarantee it. But fuck, I love her. So I met Miss Karen. And I did the same typical bullshit, and some of you people that work here can attest that when I showed up here, I thought I ran the show, right? I smuggled in more contraband than this fucking place has ever seen. I had lockers and lockers and lockers full of sodas, candies, chips, Coke. We had fucking hot dogs and hamburgers from McDonald's delivered one night. And I had a little crew of dudes that would run around and cause some commotion while we brought that shit in the side door that makes that beeping noise. We duct taped it. I never made my bed when I was here. And I was never hungry. Yeah, that's the kind of fucking piece of shit I am, right? So, I got the program. I thought I got the program. I thought I understood what was going on. And I thought that I made some connections to a higher power, whoever you choose to call that. I felt that I did. I really felt that I did. At this time, I knew that young lady back there. I couldn't stand her. She didn't know that. I'm going to tell her today. She's one of my favorite people in the entire world. But the reason that I brought her up is because we went to a lot of alumni meetings together, correct? I got out, and I thought, I'm going to go back to this house that I paid for. Well, that didn't happen. I went to an Oxford house. I don't know if any of you guys know about Oxford House. Let me tell you, that's the most amazing fucking organization I've ever been a part of. Amazing. I went to an Oxford house, and I became really tight with the four members that we had, and it was Oxford House La Casa. It's not here anymore. And I got real involved in alumni here, right? But I made one mistake. I used all that service work that I was doing to stop working a program, okay? So this is like the part where I'll start to lecture some of you guys, because I see it happen all the time. Remember that when you work a program, you work a program. AR doesn't work your program. Oxford House doesn't work your program. Service work is not a program. Service work is part of the program. You're of no service if you're empty inside when you go home and you're using because everybody knows you because you help out with all the events. I'll see you back in treatment when I come back out here. That's what's going to happen. I see it happen all the time. So I get clean and I'm part of the alumni and I love it, and Tommy and, you know, all these people that are around here, we get really close. In fact, Tommy's husband was my sponsor, Sean. I don't know if you guys know Sean, but yeah. Love that guy too, because he's got an awesome name. But I got wrapped up in that service work. And then they say that you shouldn't date anybody, right? You shouldn't date anybody for like a year, and it's fucking stupid. But it's true. Because I started dating this girl that I shouldn't have, and I knew she was bad news, and she fucking screwed me over. By the way, my sober house was one block away from a dope dealer's house. But that's how strong I was, right? Until I didn't have a program, and I got my heart broken. And I went to the corner store, and the guy says, "We have wine for sale." It was like 8 in the morning. I was like, two of them. So I relapsed and got kicked out of my Oxford house. And I was brokenhearted about that because I let down so many people. And I was also, at the time, the president of Austin Recovery Alumni. What a fucking loser I was, right? Like, hey, guys, stay sober. I'm going to go get high. It took me a lot to get over that. And I fell back into the same hole, right? Like, I was good again. Like, I went on that wave that I talk about. I'm good. And then I wasn't good, and I was drinking, which is not my favorite thing to do. I was taking pills, and I was doing cocaine. About $250 worth a day habit. Blew through 10 grand pretty quick. I went to Austin Lakes detox 3 times in like 3 weeks, and this wonderful doctor there named Dr. Lam said, "Sean, what the fuck are you doing?" in his Indian accent. I was like, "Bro, you shouldn't even talk like that." And he said, "You're going to fucking kill yourself." I am, if I kept going. So, he said, "You need to get some help." And I said, "I'll go to AR. Unfortunately, when you've been here before and you've been active, they kind of know you. And so somebody called and they said, "Oh, Sean Bautista? Yeah, we don't have to wait till Tuesday. You can bring him today." Fuck. My dad picked me up from the detox and we drove past the exit to his house and I was like, "Where the fuck are you going, stupid?" "You're going to treatment." I was like, "Motherfucker. Buy me some cigarettes." I don't smoke, by the way, but you know why you need cigarettes? Because I don't make my own fucking bed. Ask Mark. So I got here, and I was sick. I was sick for 2 more days. I saw a photo recently as I was moving my shit back from El Paso to here of the discharge paperwork, and I look fucking hot. Like, I look fucking solid. I'd fuck me, for sure. For sure. Mark, how did I look? Mark thought I was retarded. Because I didn't do anything for 2 days but rock and go, "Ah." Where's my fucking Vistaril, right? Just so you know, I popped one of those before I did this talk. It's prescribed legally. So, coming here, I can't remember. Who's the lady that has the little chihuahua? Vicky. I owe her amends like a motherfucker, let me tell you. She did my intake. She was a... My mom would fucking kill me if she knew how I talked to Miss Vicky. I think we're good now, though. As long as I don't ever come back when she's working. So, I get in this program, right? And I sit around and I see all these people. And I already know what the fuck the deal is. I've already done the book. I've already done all your stupid activities. And I don't give a shit what half you counselors say anyway, because I have more education than you do in psychology. Wrong. So I buddy up with this guy sitting over here that, I'll have you know, we got sober together merely by chance that we met each other. But when I was sent to El Paso to work for Oxford House, every time I came into town, him and I met. We had Dan's Hamburger. Still doesn't change. We just had a Dan's Hamburger and we came here. We've always stayed in contact. Because a lot of you people that are in treatment right now will say, "Yeah, we're going to go to meetings together. We're going to call each other." You're fucking lying. You're all lying. I was lying. But see, I had an advantage. I was one up for Mark, right? Because I'd been here before. And I realized the first time that all those people that were going to call me never called. So I made it a point that the day we both discharged, we said, "We will call no matter what. I don't care if you relapse. I don't care. We're going to call and check in." We still do it today. I had him over for dinner last week when I got back in town. To see him sober really makes my fucking day. And it keeps me accountable. So, I worked the program. And you know what I did? I got honest with myself. I realized, like I told you, that you don't care what kind of watch I have. You don't care what kind of fucking job I have. You don't care what kind of car I drive or what dog I have. None of you give a fuck about that. I'm the one that cares about that. Why? Because I have this burning desire to feel important. And you know what I realized? Nobody cares. They just like me for me. Not because I act like I have nice cars or money or nobody gives a shit about that. No one cares. You know what they do care about? That you show up when you're supposed to. That you answer your phone when they call you. And that you're honest with people when they don't want you to be honest with them. Right? I've seen a lot of people working in Oxford House in El Paso. I've seen several people die. I have a buddy that was living with us that got kicked out of an Oxford House. That he's going to die. He's going to die. I've personally paid for him to go to treatment 2 times. And he gets out and he does well. And then he thinks he's got it. He starts doing old Facebook shit, chatting with people that are bad people, talking about drugs, talking about gangs and shit. Right now he's in Indiana somewhere sleeping in a tent in the woods eating out of a trash can. I shit you not, I'll show you the text message. Because that's who was messaging me right before I got here. This program is meant to better yourself. Not to better other people. That's a decision I had to make about that young man that I'm referring to, because I would pay any amount of money that I could make to keep him sober, because he's going to die. Unfortunately, I can't keep him sober. If I could keep people sober, this place wouldn't exist and I'd be loaded as fuck. Right? Pay me $100,000 and you'll never use a drug again in your life. The fact of the matter is that that's not what happens. Life happens. With a program or without a program, life happens. My struggle with the higher power, I didn't know who God was, but I'd rather pray to something as an insurance policy in case fucking hell does exist, right? Buy insurance. These steps are insurance. They help you when life happens, because you're never going to stop living life. Drugs will always be there. Alcohol will always be there. Guys will break your heart. Girls will break your heart. That's just how it goes. It's what you choose to do with it. Right? And it's almost time to get out of here, but I'm going to tell you the easiest way to stay sober. When you're in trouble, call somebody.